places, everyone.
We're now broadcasting.
Roll the tape in. 3, 2.
A new audio drama.
Appaloosa Radio is where stories come alive.
Appaloosa Radio offers Dead Man Suit, an original short story. Appaloosa Radio offers Dead Man Suit, an original short story.
Every time he wore it, he thought it had a strange odor. It had been dry cleaned multiple times, and no one else noticed any sort of odor. In fact, his wife, Wilma, thought he looked spiffy in it and loved to see him in the double-breasted, brown suit with the faintest of gray pinstripes. He looks like a movie star, she proudly told her sister Grace Lynn. Far better in that suit than in the greasy dungaree overalls that he wore most of the time. But truck mechanics don't wear suits for work. They work in greasy overalls. The brown suit was for Sunday church and extra special occasions, like when they had gone to the casino and had a steak dinner for their 15th anniversary. For their anniversary dinner, Wilma had worn a Kelly green dress with lots of sparkles that matched the brown suit perfectly. She had even insisted that he pay the $5 to get a special color photograph of them together in their finery. Harlan Royce was a big-chested man and a double-breasted suit looked best on him. A single-breasted suit would make him look bulgy, he would stick out in the wrong places. But, in a double-breasted suit and with a wider, patterned tie, he looked, well, like a movie star. Still, every time Harlan Royce wore the double-breasted suit, he noticed the smell. The one that no one else noticed. Harlan Royce was 39 when his slightly older cousin, Kane, Cooter, Royce died. No one who knew both Cooter and Harlan was surprised that Cooter died flat broke and without suitable clothing for his own burial. No one would be surprised, either, that Harlan Royce paid for the suit that Cooter was buried in. Harlan was a hard-working truck mechanic who attended church and remained true to his wife. Cooter, well, not so. Cooter liked to call himself a rogue and even had the word tattooed on his left upper arm in red and blue ink. That tattoo was probably the only positive thing to result from Cooter's brief time in the United States Navy. He had been thrown into the brig for stealing government property. A more accurate charge would have been that Cooter used Navy trucks to commit felonies, specifically the transport of untaxed liquors across state lines and onto U.S. military bases. Cooter called himself a liquor supplier. 20 years earlier, he would have been called a bootlegger. Cooter Royce had been a bootlegger before he joined the Navy in a temporary bout of patriotic fever. He was a bootlegger while in the Navy, and he was a bootlegger after his dishonorable discharge. In fact, he remained a bootlegger for his entire adult life. He was a bootlegger, a thief, a con man, a liar, a womanizer, a no-account who spent all his money as quickly as he got it. Rogue was an apt descriptor. The family could have kept the coffin closed and clothing, or lack thereof, would not have mattered, but Grandma Helen Jean, the matriarch of the Royce clan, would not hear of her grandson being buried without suitable dress. She believed that when one met one's maker, they must be dressed appropriately. A man in a good suit always looked better than one who faced the pearly gates stark naked. So, the Royce clan faced the task of finding suitable attire for the now deceased Kane Douglas Royce, Jr., who was never known by that name, but to everyone was always Cooter. Many folks think of Al Capone when they hear the word bootlegger. When they learned that Kane Douglas Royce, Jr. operated from Dogwood City, Tennessee, a dry town in a dry county, they might want to call Cooter a moonshiner. A moonshiner instead of a bootlegger. They imagined that the liquor that Cooter transported was a cornache, clandestinely manufactured in a still, well hidden at the dark hollow, and then poured into gallon jugs with a handy handle, for drinking straight from the jug. Moonshine is an illicit liquor without taste, but with a powerful kick. While it is true that Dogwood City, Tennessee had its share of moonshiners, that was not the kind of business that Cooter was engaged in. He transported liquor manufactured by one of the country's largest and oldest whiskey distillers, an American top-shelf whiskey that discerning consumers asked for by name. However, the well-known whiskey company also manufactured a lower-grade product that it sold in unlabeled bottles to designated wholesalers who put their own labels on the product. When the wholesaler put their own label on the whiskey, they were also compelled to pay the federal excise tax. Until the product was labeled, there was no excise tax due. It was a raw, unfinished product. Federal and state revenue agents were not worried about the unlabeled whiskey because they had chosen to strictly control liquor at the consumer end. No liquor store would ever attempt to sell whiskey without its federal excise tax sticker. The feds and the various states were vigorous in their enforcement on liquor stores, and everyone knew it. selling even one bottle of untaxed liquor would result in a liquor store losing its license. So, Cooter Royce did not sell his unlabeled whiskey to liquor stores, nary a bottle. Cooter's customers wanted whiskey, but they did not want to buy it from liquor stores, nor did they want to pay federal and state tax on it. To understand who Cooter's customers were, we need to step into the murky depths of the various state liquor control systems that were enacted after the end of Prohibition, particularly states like Mississippi. Why Mississippi? Well, that is where Cooter Royce sold most of his unlabeled, untaxed whiskey. In Mississippi, Prohibition continued a full decade after it was rescinded in the rest of the country. Cooter's father was also a bootlegger, and he sold his product directly to illicit suppliers in places like Jackson and Biloxi. By the time Cooter entered the family business, things had begun to change in Mississippi. Like most other southern states, Mississippi moved to open state-owned liquor stores, where an individual could purchase a bottle or two of liquor for one's own personal consumption. Liquor sold by the drink was strictly outlawed. The state was permitting individual choice but prohibiting bars, and the degenerate culture, assumed to be associated with bars. Now, if a fine dining restaurant wanted to serve cocktails, it could serve the fixings but not the alcohol. However, if a customer just happened to have a bottle of liquor with them, then the barkeep was allowed to mix the customer's own alcohol into the drink. Not exactly the way that they showed in the movies, but it was what Mississippi required. So, the customer's liquor had to be purchased at a state-run liquor store, which as you might expect in a southern, Bible Belt state were never open on Sundays, nor were they open on Saturdays. No, these stores operated Monday to Friday, from 9 until 5, but with an hour when they were closed for lunch. These stores limited how much a customer could buy, and they charged a premium price for everything they sold. Finally, the Restaurant Association approached the legislature with a new proposal. Could high-class restaurants maintain lockers where regular customers could store their own liquor? The legislature enthusiastically approved. So, regular customers at many restaurants had lockers where individual customers kept their own liquor locked with their own key. Out-of-town visitors could also get a keyed locker. Maybe one where the previous owner, whoever that may be, had left a bottle or two behind. Suppose a regular customer forgot to bring their own liquor. Surely, common courtesy would require that the restaurant find a way to help them. Again, a forgotten locker by a previous customer might be helpful. Now, the state of Mississippi was not in the practice of inspecting the private lockers of the customers of its finest restaurants. So, once liquor was locked into a customer's locker, it was treated as private property that was safe from state scrutiny. Cooter Royce built his business selling directly to restaurants who operated their own customer liquor lockers. At these restaurants, a customer would order a cocktail, the barkeep would go in the back room where the lockers were kept, use a key to open one, add the liquor to the drink, then replace the bottle, and lock everything back up. Everything was safe from the state's scrutiny.
Yeah.
In Tennessee, Cooter told everyone that he was in the cough syrup business. To some extent, that was true. During Prohibition, cough syrup laced with whiskey was sold over the counter in many drug stores. There were as many different recipes as there were stores. Each pharmacist created their own concoction. Since the concoctions were sold as medicine, they were permitted by the Volstead Act, and after the repeal of Prohibition, no federal excise taxes were collected on cough syrup. Even as he sold unlabeled and untaxed whiskey to various Mississippi restaurants, he also sold his whiskey to a single pharmacy in Tupelo, Mississippi. In that one customer, Cooter's enterprise was legitimate. No laws were broken. If he wished to appear legitimate, he would show his card purporting to represent Dogwood City Pharmaceuticals Limited. It was a firm with no other employees. Twice a month, Cooter would load 100 cases of unlabeled whiskey into his panel truck and then drive it straight through to his Mississippi customers. It usually took him 2 or 3 days to sell it all, and then, with a wad of cash in his pocket, would start the meander back home. His homeward meander would always include an extended stop at Hot Springs, Arkansas. Cooter had no interest in the medicinal hot springs. He never spent a nickel at any of the establishments on Bathhouse Row. His financial support went, instead, to the casinos, to the brothels, to the auction houses, and to the swanky nightclubs. You see, Hot Springs, Arkansas did not really exist. Ask any member of the Arkansas State Legislature, or the governor, or the attorney general, or any of the state's district judges. Gambling was illegal, punishable by large fines and long prison terms. Prostitution was never legal in Arkansas. Liquor by the drink was not permitted. No one in Arkansas would openly buy diamonds and gems stolen in Florida. Such activities never happened in the Razorback State. However, Hot Springs, Arkansas was not a figment. It existed for two reasons: bribes and the policy of local control. Everyone was on the take. Money generated on Hot Springs gambling tables made its way into the pockets of every elected official. No exceptions. No exceptions. No exceptions. The city of Hot Springs was allowed local control over the activities in its jurisdictional limits. Ever so often, someone from one of the casinos would be arrested and fined $10 for operating an illegal operation. Of course, that same casino netted several thousands every day. The madam from one of the city's busiest brothels had advertisements on the high school's football field. Diamonds stolen in Florida were openly sold to tourists at the city's auction houses. Booze. Well, it was everywhere. Always available. Twice a month, on his homeward meander, Cooter Royce would stop in Hot Springs where his large wad of cash would dwindle to a couple pair of $5 bills, barely enough for a craps game. Cooter remained a bootlegger for his entire adult life. He was a bootlegger, a thief, a con man, a liar, a womanizer, a no-account who spent all his money as quickly as he got it. Twice a month, on his homeward meander, Cooter Royce would stop in Hot Springs where his large wad of cash would dwindle to a couple pair of $5 bills, barely enough for a craps game. Then, he would come home and need to borrow cash from others to pay for his next shipment of unlabeled whiskey. Needless to say, the loan sharks in Hot Springs were always willing to help him out. Very friendly guys, they were. Until Cooter missed some of his payments. Harlan Royce made $4.12 an hour as a truck mechanic for the Rogers Brothers Shipping and Transport Company. Since he often worked half days on Saturday, that worked out to about $181.28 a week. His slightly older cousin could easily earn $2,000 in a single trip down to Mississippi. Yet, time after time after time, Cooter came by Harlan's house with two cold beers in his hands asking for money to tide me by. He would drink one of the beers and hand the other to Harlan. Now, Wilma did not like Harlan to be drinking beer in their garage. So, most of the time, Harlan would refuse the beer and Cooter would drink both. Times are hard. Ain't nobody wanting cough syrup. If I don't pay my loan by Friday, the bank will take my truck. Then, I won't have nothing to earn a living with. Another time, I tell you cousin, I was robbed. Pointed a revolver right at my head and took all my money. Two men. In masks. Maybe, I think about, there was a third one, standing guard for the other two. Yet, another pitch was, I ain't got no money to feed my kids. Give me $100 and I'll pay you back. Of course, he never did. Finally, Wilma had had enough of her soft-hearted husband giving their money away to his no-good cousin. Harlan had to tell Cooter that he would no longer be able to help him. Wilma just would not let him. Harlan was surprised to see his older cousin begin crying. Crying like a baby. Harlan could not take it. He gave Cooter the $5 he had hidden away for a special fishing rod. The long history between Harlan Royce and his slightly older cousin can only be described as stressful. Nor did it become less stressful after Cooter died. Cooter Royce loaded his usual 100 cases of unlabeled whiskey into his now aging wintergreen Dodge panel truck. The truck had once belonged to a bakery that brought bread and pastries directly to households. In those days, it had a bright golden sun painted on its side with the words Best of the Morning just below it. When Cooter acquired it, it had been through two previous owners and the golden sun had been scraped off, but no one had bothered to repaint the spot, so it had begun to rust. Nor had they bothered to remove the words that had been below the sun. Best of the Morning in now faded lettering below a large, rusted spot. The winter green panel truck was unique, and very easy to identify. This trip, his last one, began as they always did. Cooter had packed his suitcase with his special casino clothes, bright colored silk shirts, white gabardine slacks, and his Weekender sport coat. Of course, He would never wear his casino clothes when he was actually selling whiskey. They might get dirty and that would spoil the effect that Cooter wanted. No, when he was working, he wore blue jeans, a flannel-lined denim jacket, and sturdy, black engineer's boots. The casino clothes were for the good times he expected in Hot Springs, Arkansas, on his slow meander back to Dogwood City in East Tennessee. On his last trip, Cooter took the same route he always did, dropping down Highway 134 and entering Mississippi at the crossroads town of Winnesaga. Cooter always avoided the major highways, staying, rather, on the less traveled country roads. He noticed the black Buick turn from a dirt side road onto Highway 134 but did not think much about it. To be sure, there were far more pickup trucks than black Buicks on the kinds of roads that Cooter preferred. Still, one fancy car was nothing to worry about. He had made this same trip many times before. The black Buick turned onto Highway 134 and then sped up quickly, racing up behind the Dodge panel truck. Cooter pulled to the right, allowing the impatient Buick to pass. However, the Buick had no intention of passing. Its sole intent was to stay glued to Cooter's back bumper. What the? Cooter yelled to himself. Cooter was so fixed on the black Buick behind him, he did not notice the six Mississippi State Patrol cars pull out from a side road and form a phalanx in front of him. He was trapped. It was late on a Thursday afternoon that Grandma Helen Jean Royce received an unexpected phone call from a mortuary in Corinth, Mississippi. The caller said that he had just spoken with the chief of police for Dogwood City and the police chief told him that she was the next of kin for the now deceased Cain Douglas Royce, Jr. Grandma Helen Jean could not believe that her beloved grandson Dougie was now dead. The mortuary attendant described the deceased and added that he had a colorful tattoo on his shoulder with the word Rogue. The Mississippi mortuary wanted to know her plans for the body. Grandma Helen Jean broke down in tears and told them to call her grandson Harlan. Thank you. Bringing Cooter's body back from Mississippi cost Harlan $325. That bought a temporary travel coffin and the transportation costs for the two mortuary attendants. The real coffin would have to be purchased separately in Dogwood City, where the real funeral would run another $600. Flowers, a minister, and after the service food added another $300. Paying for his cousin's funeral expenses had drained Harlan and Wilma's small savings account. And Grandma's insistence on a nice suit posed yet another difficult financial problem for Harlan. Harlan's first idea was to buy a suit at a second-hand store. It would look plenty nice and not cost much. Wilma liked the idea, remembering all of the times that Cooter had come begging for money. However, Grandma Helen Jean would not hear of such an idea. No. She firmly insisted on a nice suit, and by nice she specifically clarified she meant a $100 suit. When Cooter's body was delivered to Dogwood City, Tennessee, Harlan was also given copies of both the official police report and the findings of the coroner's inquest. Harlan Royce was never clear about what had happened to Cooter. He drew diagrams, read and reread the police reports. He talked to a retired Tennessee trooper asking for his opinions. He even drove down to Winnesogget to see things for himself. Yet, try as much as he could not figure it out. Cooter had been driving his Dodge panel truck south on Highway 134 when, just as he crossed the state line, the black Buick came up behind him. Harlan now knew he was in the black Buick. It was the Mississippi State Commissioner of Public Safety, the state's highest-ranking law enforcement officer, who was being driven in his official state vehicle by his official chauffeur, Corporal David Patterson. Down the road about 3 miles, six Mississippi State troopers waited in their cars. At the signal from the commissioner, they pulled onto the highway, forming a phalanx blocking Cooter. It was what happened next that Harlan never understood. Somehow, Cooter broke away from the trap and ended up driving on an unmaintained service road under the power transmission towers, bringing TVA electricity to Mississippi. Harlan was a mechanic, and he knew the old panel truck was not in the best of mechanical shape. Besides, those types of vehicles were never designed for intense driving on unmaintained service roads. He was not surprised to learn that 4 miles from the paved highway, the state troopers found the panel truck unable to move further. Its engine was blown. However, Harlan never understood what was supposed to have happened next. The official police report said that Cooter had climbed one of the high-voltage power transmission towers and was over 200 feet above the ground, climbing still higher when troopers arrived on the scene. It reported that Cooter had grabbed one of the high-voltage lines, being electrocuted instantly. It also reported that Cooter's body remained suspended on the high-voltage line until the following day, when crews from the utility company could arrive with the equipment necessary to recover it. But Harlan wondered, did Cooter choose to climb the tower, or was he driven there by the troopers? Maybe they were shooting at him, and he climbed to avoid their bullets. Or maybe he thought they would not see him up there. It could have been a place to hide. When Harlan drove down to Winnisaugut to see things for himself, he was surprised about how hard it was to climb one of the high-voltage towers. Just to reach the first cross piece, Cooter had to climb a nearly vertical leg for over 50 feet, and the tower's leg was studded with razor-sharp metal spikes. And Cooter was wearing clunky engineer's boots, which would probably have made climbing difficult. Then, to reach the high voltage lines themselves required another twisting climb up the tower's narrow arm. Harlan thought the climb up the tower to the height of the high voltage lines would have been extremely arduous, requiring a man in excellent physical shape. That was not Cooter. Even in high school, he was a non-athlete, preferring to sit in the stands and yell encouragement instead of playing on the field. Harlan tried to figure it out. Especially, the conclusion from the coroner's inquest. That one individual named Kane Douglas Royce Jr. probably died as a result of an attempted suicide. Cooter's death was not given much attention in Dogwood City. He was a bootlegger, a thief, a con man, a liar, a womanizer, a no-account who spent all his money as quickly as he got it. Over the years, Cooter's friends had all abandoned him, having been the victim of his many scams and schemes. They saw how he had abandoned his wife and his daughters, how he had affairs with married women, how he gambled and drank, how he exploited everyone he knew. Everybody knew it would come. He had angered someone, probably some other bootlegger, and they had arranged for his demise. Everyone knew it would come. His death received even less attention in Mississippi. It was barely reported in the newspapers. No one seemed concerned that the state's highest level police officer personally took part in the capture of a small-time bootlegger. The only thing that was strange was that the bootlegger had climbed a high-voltage electrical transmission tower. Didn't the bootlegger realize how dangerous that was? Only the Royce family cared, and that was merely because Grandma Helen Jean insisted on a proper funeral and burial in the family cemetery. A proper funeral, she insisted, required that Kane Douglas Royce Jr. wear a suit. Not just any suit, but a good one. One that would make his heavenly maker proud. Keeping Grandma Helen Jean happy fell to Harlan, Cooter's slightly younger cousin. It always did. She expected it. He knew that she did. Paying for his cousin's funeral expenses had drained Harlan and Wilma's small savings account, and Grandma's insistence on a nice suit posed yet another difficult financial problem for Harlan. Harlan's first idea was to buy a suit at a second-hand store. It would look plenty nice and not cost much. Wilma liked the idea, remembering all of the times that Cooter had come begging for money. However, Grandma Helen Jean would not hear such an idea. No. She firmly insisted on a nice suit, and by nice she specifically clarified she meant a $100 suit. Now Harlan had never worn a $100 suit. Not even for his wedding. That suit had cost $49.95. It was blue, single-breasted. After 2 or 3 years, Harlan could no longer wear it. His chest and belly had grown too large for it. Then, for a while, he wore some hand-me-down suits from his Uncle Doug, Cooter's dad, who was also a bootlegger and could afford nice clothes. His uncle was nearly the same size as Harlan, so, the fit was okay. But, Uncle Doug had died in 1951. The suits were way out of date. Finally, when his son graduated from high school, Harlan bought another suit, the one he still wears to church on Sundays. The suit was a markdown special at JCPenney's and cost only $38. Wilma adjusted the cuffs of the pants herself instead of paying the store $10 to do it. $100 suit just to bury him. He'll rot and stink in 6 months. That suit will be ruined. Harlan had a private conversation with Mr. Cecil Miller, the owner of Miller's Mountain Mortuary. Did the funeral director have any suggestions for Harlan's predicament? It turned out that he did. He knew a tailor in Knoxville who specialized in making burial suits that looked great from the front, but that had no back. It was easy for a funeral director to dress a body with such a suit. More importantly, it was very easy for the funeral director to quickly undress the body, removing the suit, so it could be used for another purpose. Once the coffin lid was closed, no one knew that the suit had been removed. He suggested that Harlan go to Knoxville and pick out a fabric that he really liked. Then the tailor would stitch up the front of the suit to fit Harlan's dimensions. Once the burial suit was ready, Harlan would bring it up to Dogwood City and Mr. Miller would dress Cooter in it. After the funeral, while the casket was being readied for transit to the cemetery, he would remove the suit and store it for Harlan. Then, Harlan could take the suit back to the Knoxville tailor and have the backside added. That way, Harlan would have a new suit. And, for all this, Mr. Miller added, "We, the tailor and the funeral director, would only charge you $125. Thus, both cousins, Harlan and Cooter, would have $100 suits. Wilma approved of the plan, but forswore she wanted to know nothing about it. At the funeral, Grandma Helen Jean was ecstatic. Doug Jr. looked so handsome. She did not know how much funeral makeup Mr. Miller had to use to return natural color to a burned, blackened body. Some secrets die with deceased, including what they are actually wearing when they are buried in the ground. Two weeks after the funeral, Harlan stopped by the mortuary and was given a nondescript cardboard box. In exchange, he gave Mr. Miller five $20 bills and five ones. No receipt was given. In Knoxville, the tailor finished the new suit in just 3 days. As a special courtesy, he had the suit dry cleaned. When Harlan came to pick it up, there was no charge. Just a simple alteration, the tailor said. Every time Harlan Royce wore the brown suit, he believed he smelled a strange odor. He tried covering the odor with expensive aftershave lotion. Everyone noticed the aftershave lotion, but no one noticed the strange odor from the suit that Harlan smelled. The suit had been dry cleaned multiple times and no one else noticed any sort of odor. Probably just in my own head, Harlan concluded. Still, it was a distinctive smell that came to him only when he wore the suit. He repeated saying, "Probably just in my own head," until he almost believed it. Even so, he wore the suit often because Wilma thought it looked spiffy and loved to see him wear it. "He looks like a movie star," she proudly told her younger sister Grace Lynn. About a month after Cooter's funeral, Harlan decided to get a tattoo. Now, Harlan had always hated the look of tattoos and he feared needle pricks. Yet, there he was on Saturday afternoon spending $25 on a multicolored tattoo with the words "Mechanical Man." Wilma was astonished when she learned that, on his own, Harlan had gotten a tattoo. She remembered how hard it was to get him into the doctor's office for a tetanus shot after he had cut his hand on some old, rusty roof metal. It wasn't a bad tattoo. Just something she never expected. She was even more surprised a couple months later when Harlan announced that he had purchased plane tickets for Las Vegas. Now, Harlan was never one for gambling. He had grown up in the Pentecostal church and gambling was one of the seven unforgivable sins. Wilma did not object to the trip. It would probably be fun. Still, it was so unlike Harlan. Then, Harlan joined a bowling league, one that played late on Friday nights. Harlan never stayed up past his 9:30 p.m. bedtime. The league's games did not start until midnight and often continued to nearly dawn. Still, Harlan never missed a single game. And, he often had a beer or two during the games. In fact, he stopped working at the trucking company on Saturday mornings because it interfered with his bowling league. Now, Harlan had always been the first to ask to work on Saturdays. He had always appreciated the extra money. The strangest change that had come over Harlan since he had begun wearing the $100 suit was his fixation about what had happened to his slightly older cousin in Winnosaga, Mississippi. Not that he could do anything about it. Somebody very powerful, had wanted Cooter dead. That is a given. Harlan would never be able to learn who or why. Nobody ever talks about that kind of stuff. No. What Harlan wanted to know was why Cooter had chosen to climb up the high-voltage transmission towers. How did that benefit his potential escape? Why did he do it? Harlan spent multiple Sundays driving down to Winnisauga instead of attending church services. He would stand beneath the high-voltage towers and stare up. He could hear the wires sing in the wind. Occasionally, there was a sharp zing or pop when the high-voltage wires shot out brief bursts of electrical energy. Otherwise, there was nobody. Nothing to see. Nothing to hear. One Sunday afternoon, he brought strong leather gloves, and he decided, against his better judgment, to climb up.
Appaloosa Springs Audio Theater is a creative collaboration whose purpose is to write, produce, and share original story content through webcast radio experiences.